Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, 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 hello. Again, I'm so glad to be here talking with you that I've changed the format for today, consistent with the basic changes I'm making. And I announced on my website, and I announced to you through my frequent flyer, frequent alerts, I've announced that today I'm taking callers. This is a Taking Caller Wednesday, and I'm going to be doing that periodically, depending on how it goes. And you can call me about anything. And by the way, I see I already have a call. I won't take it quite yet. From India. Hang on. And we have four or five lines. So if we fill them up, I'll be a grateful and happy host. And I want you to, and we got another call from Michigan. So we're going to have a good caller show today, right at the start. I mean, God bless you, my audience. I need you. Can't do this kind of thing on my own. And call about anything you want. You can talk about anything that you think I might be interested in, or my audience, or this wonderful group of folks out there might want to hear about, offer a thought, offer a criticism, offer an idea about the show, tell us an experience you've had. You know, we do focus on mental health and psychology and human well-being and things like that. And we're critical of drugs and electroshock and lobotomy and involuntary treatment and things like that. So you can just sort of pick and choose what you're going to talk about. And I had planned to start with a monologue that talked about something of interest to me, but I'm just going to launch into callers. I'm going to take you in order. Anish from India. Hello.
Yes, sir. Hello, sir.
Hi. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes, sir, I can. May I ask?
Yes.
May I ask a question, sir?
Sure.
Okay. Is schizophrenia incurable?
Oh, well, that's a very, very, very good question. First of all, schizophrenia is a term that's used to describe all sorts of things. And it often describes people who are shy and withdrawn and are having odd experiences, unlike other people. They may hear things. But the term is really mostly a term of abuse. So, you know, so I don't much like it in that regard. I want to say that the people who get labeled schizophrenic are being abused by the label itself, and in fact, often can go on to have better lives than they ever did before, provided they can find resources that will help. Well, what helps somebody who's feeling shy and uncertain and having difficulty connecting and maybe started to feel that way by teenage years and has now been to a psychiatrist and has described unusual experiences and an alternative reality and has been called schizophrenic? Well, I think the first thing is let go of the diagnosis. That's the first step on the way to being better off. And then let go of the concept of treatment and cure, because we're not dealing with a disease. Despite what my colleagues say, this has nothing whatsoever at all, not at all, to do with diabetes or with any other kinds of diseases like dementia or neurological diseases. What gets called schizophrenia is a human experience. And it's a part of the human range of experience. And if you are experiencing some of what I've been describing, and you've lost trust in human beings, and you feel insecure around people, and you're withdrawing into your own world, I think the answer is to build relationships. As scary as it is, and as frightening it is, it's to build relationships. And if you're trying to help somebody, a family member, or a client, or a loved one, relate to them. Try to find a way to encourage trust, to encourage caring, to be trusting together, to be peaceful together. And that is the start of coming back from these experiences. What do you think? What do you think of what I'm saying, Anish?
Absolutely, sir. I have been reading. I've read the names that you just said of the books. I have all of them. I have read all three of them, and I'm following what you are saying. I'm talking about my son. I am 48, and my son is 20. He's been diagnosed as schizophrenic, and we are trying to cure him without drugs. He's taking help of your videos, books. I got him off the medications, but he's back again on medications, and I'm trying to get him off, sir, again. And in the process, I have given this call trying to get in touch with you to get some more help, sir.
Yeah, well, I'm not in a position to treat anybody in India or to have anybody come from India to be seen by me. I keep a small practice. I mean, that's the problem. I'm not going to be your ultimate resource. My books are, my radio, whatever I can do, my videos, to help you. It would be wonderful if you could find someone to help you and your son relate to each other. Because whenever you have this kind of a situation going on, you are perhaps your son's best hope for bettering his life. Because if he can find a new way of relating to you, and you can find a new way of relating to him, which is non-medical, doesn't talk about schizophrenia, but talks about, son, how can we grow to trust each other? How can we grow to care about each other? What can we do together that won't be frightening for you? And above all else, reduce the negative communications. Avoid the natural tendency to get frustrated and angry, and try to make all your communications beautiful and loving and caring as much as you can, and ask and even beg your son to treat you in the same way, to start something new together. And if you could find some sort of a counselor, I just don't know what's available where you are, who could help you and your son talk together, I think that would be a really good thing. And maybe if he's willing to read Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, and the last third of it is all about how to develop relationship.
Yes, sir. May I ask next question, sir? If I'm in the queue, or may I?
Sure, go ahead, and
okay,
then
so
I'm going.
The,
then I want
sir,
to
what
move
is the
on. This
of
is a very important one. We could spend a whole lot of day on this. But we do. But thank goodness, all the lines are filled up right now. I'm very, very
pleased.
Yeah,
that's why, sir. That's why I asked you if I can.
Yeah, please go ahead. Because what you're asking about is so important.
What is, sir, the symptoms of TD? Are they at tardive dyskinesia? Are they available while the patient is on antipsychotics, or during withdrawal, or both?
Yes, they can break through when the patient is on tardive dyskinesia. It was on the drugs, the antipsychotic drugs, and then they can get worse during withdrawal. And then sometimes, if you catch it early enough, it will even the person will your son will even recover. And there's a lot on my website about tardive dyskinesia, and there's a fair amount of, about it in my books, which you say you've looked at. So that's good. But it can develop at any time during the treatment. But it often shows up. It gets unmasked when you stop the drug. And Anish, feel free to call me back when I do another one of these shows, and let us know how you and your son are doing, okay?
Yes, sir. Sure, sir.
Thank you so much for calling all the way from India. And what a wonderful way to start. Nancy in Michigan, hi.
Yes, hi. Hello, Dr. Bregan. My question is, how do you treat a mania episode without psychiatric drugs, especially when it reaches a level of danger for the safety of the person involved?
Well, it's the hardest question in the world, and there's no easy answer for it. What I try to do in my practice is to see what is going on with my client as early as possible. So if my client comes in and is acting a little silly and then mind is spinning, then I say, hey, how are you doing? Did you sleep well last night? And the answer is almost always, no, I'm up all night and I'm fine. And then I try to use reason and talk about what I'm feeling and experiencing coming from them, what I think they're experiencing, which is they recently had a loss that we both know about, and maybe the depression's getting too painful. And then I'll talk with them about their depression and about what is happening to them. And I am often able to help people without medication. Now, medication isn't going to help a person, but it can restrain them. And so we're stuck in an impossible situation with no good solution when you have an out-of-control person who doesn't want help and is just threatening and wasting all their money and getting the family in trouble and so on. And I don't have an easy solution for that. And I think it's up to a family to decide whether, for example, to commit somebody in the hope that they can get some help. I won't do it myself. I tell all my people who come to work with me that I would never lock you up. And once or twice in the past couple of years, maybe two or three times, say in the last 6 years or so, one of my patients in a manic episode has come to me, has been too high, and I haven't been able to do anything by talking, and they get into trouble, and they end up in a hospital, and they get drugged. But it's not a good solution. So my own view of it is that what we really need is institutions that are voluntary, where people can go to and just be surrounded by caring people. And that's what we had in the so-called moral era of therapy. Look up a little book by Bachov and a psychiatrist and see that the results, looking back, were so good when the usually religiously oriented Quaker facilities would just offer a lot of care and a lot of attention. But then if somebody is so out of control they're going to injure themselves, it's just a very difficult and I don't think an easy solution. But when you lock people up, they resent it. They don't usually ever want to have it. They often don't want to have anything more to do with psychiatry. So I don't have an easy one for you.
Well,
tell me what you're thinking.
I could tell you a long story because we've dealt with psychiatry, and it's horrendous. It's inhumane how they treat people.
That's right. That's why I don't like to put people into hospitals. Even voluntarily, I never put anybody in against their will. But sometimes I'll encourage somebody and say, look, I'm so worried about you. You're not responding. The other thing I'll do is I'll say, and this is, I have a small practice. I'll say, listen, I know you can't afford six times a week, but I'll see you six times this week because I don't want you to go into a hospital. And often people respond to a lot of wisdom and care. But it's a very, very tough problem, and I'm glad you're verifying that mental hospitals are not a good solution.
How do you help someone? Our situation seems to be there's a problem with sleeping. It's ongoing. Even when there's no mania, there's a problem with sleeping. How do you help someone? Because that's what triggers it. If the sleep goes,
who is this someone, may I ask? Because it depends on your relationship so much. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. It seems to be a sleep problem.
Can you tell me who the is this relationship with a husband or a wife, or would you rather
a
not?
Child.
I mean, a child, mm-hmm. Mother.
An adult child.
Well, And does this person live with you?
Yes. Well, for the moment, for the moment.
Yeah.
The most important
thing for helping somebody sleep is to help them deal with their loneliness and anxiety at bedtime. And one of the best things for that are loving rituals. If I'm anxious at night, if something really difficult coming up, or if Ginger just says, "You settle down, honey, and I'm going to hold your hand, and we're going to talk, and I'm going to remember you, remind you I love you and God loves you," and I get into feeling peaceful and feeling like the world is going to work out okay, then I can go to sleep. If I can't do that, I can't go to sleep. So the most important thing you could do with your son, if he's willing, is develop some sort of routine of a loving ritual relationship, playing cards together, watching something fun on television, not the usual stuff. I like comedies. I like romantic comedies because I watch them with Ginger. Encouraging your son to have his own ritual of taking a shower or a bath or listening to music or putting on something soothing, doing meditation, getting some help through meditation, through various kinds of self-awareness, relaxation techniques. But I think maybe the most important thing you could figure out with him would be, what can we do together while you're staying here, which is going to help you be peaceful at night? I hope that's useful.
The whole nightmare started after he was given an antidepressant because he lost weight. Well, it turned out he had a major gastrointestinal disorder. But when they adjusted the dose on the antidepressant, he got mania. And since then, he went through a nightmare. I mean, I'm sure you know. And since then, when he can't sleep, this will put him into it. And we just have had the hardest time getting him.
Well, drugs are not going to do it in the long run. As you're aware. So, listen, why don't you see if you can figure out something like this? And again, we got a great response here. Our phones are all filled, and we're going to be able to do this, which is really a wonderful thing. So I didn't know we were going to do this, me and my audience, me and you. So call back again later at another open mic time, and I'm going to be announcing them regularly, and do some follow-up on this. And also go Google, getting help with sleep, non-drug. I mean, learn as much as you can about it. Let me take another call now, okay? Molly, I think you're in line. You hung up and now you're back. Hello? I can't hear you. No, I'm sorry. The connection is terrible. Why don't you check back in and see if you can make a decent connection? Let's go to Savita in Canada.
Hi there, Dr. Bregan. Can you hear me?
Oh, my gosh. You sound like you're next door. I'm having a really wonderful time. I've got India and Michigan and Canada. We're going to go to Chicago soon and hang on there. Ohio, we'll get to you. So what's up? What are we doing today?
This is a bit more of a very serious issue, but I think it's going to be important for people to hear this as well. I'm 28 years old. I was working as a correctional officer here, and I was on an antidepressant that I was using that wasn't really helping me, but I cold turkeyed off of it. And then I was having muscle pain from the withdrawal, so I reinstated it about 14 months later. And I developed akathisia from it. After the
reinstatement... What was the drug? I may have gotten distracted by all these incoming messages about calls. What was the drug you were on?
It was amitriptyline.
Okay, an older antidepressant. Go ahead with your story.
So I got some advice to reinstate it. I am now learning after doing research a little too late. It was it was too late to be reinstating after being off for that long. And I developed severe akathisia, which I'm sure you're aware what that's like. And
let me tell folks. I mean, a severe akathisia is like spelled akathisia, and it literally means the inability to sit still. It actually feels like somebody's gotten inside you and is torturing you from the inside out. Or imagine when we used to have chalkboards, maybe you don't even know about them, but it would be a terrible screech sometimes down the board and everybody'd shiver. Well, imagine that going down your spine. People get terrible feelings in their hands and their feet. They can't sit still. They get burning sensations. It can be just a terrible experience. And what was it like for you? Savita, what was it like for you?
It continues to be the worst experience I think a human can ever go through. I don't have any words to explain what is happening, and I would never wish this on anybody.
Give it a try. I know that the experience of akathisia is that it's almost impossible to put it into words, but give a try to putting it into words. It might help you. Where do you feel it?
I feel it from head to toe in my whole body. It's inescapable. It just feels like you're on fire from the inside, and there's no way to stop it. Like, I've found a community with other people that have it, and people seem to say, like, they try to pace and rock and stuff, but, you know, it doesn't help. It feels like you're on fire, and, you know, when someone's on fire, they might run around and move around, but it's not like it helps. It's just...
Yeah. Now, usually, amitriptyline is not typically going to cause a permanent akathisia. And was that the only drug you were taking?
No. Well, what happened was, like, I stopped the amitriptyline. It continued. And then I was in really bad shape. I went to the hospital. And I actually, at this point, had known what was happening. I knew it was withdrawal. And I tried to explain to the psychiatrist. I was like, this is what's happening. And I found this online community, and he said, no, it's all in your head. You're just having anxiety, and it's not the stuff you're reading online. And he kind of, like, got mad at me, and he just told me to start taking Ativan. So then I started Ativan, and it wasn't helping. And then I came off the Ativan, and then things just got worse from there. So now I'm just wondering if this is, like,
well, first, I'm not sure what you have, because it's so hard for you to describe it. And so I don't know if it's akathisia or not. Let me just put in a caveat for the audience in general. I'm not practicing medicine and giving you direct medical advice. I'm going to give you some direct psychological advice sometimes. But when it gets to these complexities, like, what do you do with somebody who's out of control? Or you get to the complexities of diagnosing something like akathisia. It is not going to be possible for me to do that, because that takes time. It takes time together, preferably either together or on video or Skyping. But so I'll probably have to put that caveat in every session at one time or another, that you need to be looking for some sort of medical help that can help you define an issue like this. So, Savita, I'm not sure what you have, because you can't describe it to me. So
it's like an electrical sensation going from head to toe, and it's really
strange. Does it go away? All right, now that sounds like what sometimes is an akathisia. And it pushes you to want to move about. Does it get worse when you're tense and nervous?
It gets worse when I try to lay down or rest or sit. And it's just head to toe. It's insane. Yeah. And then it'll go
Let me ask you again. When you go to sleep at night, it makes it hard for you to lie down. But when you fall asleep, do you get relief and not be awakened by it?
I don't even really barely fall asleep now because of it. And then it'll sometimes it just shuts off on its own. Like it'll be from 100 to 0, just shut off on its own. And then it'll start again.
And your only drug exposure you've been in the hospital. They must have. Have you been on antipsychotic drugs? Because they can cause much more likely to cause a permanent akathisia than amitriptyline.
I was on Seroquel in the past, like years ago, before the amitriptyline for sleep.
Okay, well, I think that may be partly what happened, that maybe you got triggered from being on the Seroquel, because Seroquel can cause a permanent akathisia called tardive akathisia. And maybe then it got aggravated. This amitriptyline has enough capacity to cause the akathisia that it may have been aggravated by the Seroquel. Is that the only other drug you've been on that can cause this?
I've been on and off many medications in the past.
So it
I think that
may not
like,
be the amitriptyline. Are you able to find any help, anybody to help you?
No. And I've tried different medications.
Have you gone to a movement disorder clinic? Are you near a big, where are you in Canada?
In Toronto.
Yeah. Have you been to a movement disorder clinic? To see, they're not always going to give you the right answer, but the movement disorder clinic people at least should know what akathisia is and be able to talk to you about it and clarify the diagnosis. Have you tried that?
No, it seems like most doctors and neurologists I'm talking to are not acknowledging it whatsoever.
You might try a movement disorder clinic, and I think that certainly an akathisia, if that's what you have, I'm not sure, but it certainly could be. Doctors have a lot of trouble diagnosing it. They do. But I would suggest, my one suggestion would be try a movement disorder clinic. Call the University of Toronto or some other place and, try that. Try a movement disorder clinic. Savita, I'm going to move on, and really all the callers today have just been so spot on, and I'm hoping down the line I'll hear from all of you again. Let me go now to Dr. Matt. Am I pronouncing it right in Chicago?
This is Dr. Ma'at.
Ma'at, hi.
Hi. You probably don't remember me, but you warned me and my group about the violence initiative.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, I wanted to thank you for having these guys.
How long ago was that? How long?
Between 1991 and 1995.
Yes. Well, listen, folks, if you want to know what we're talking about, it's out of print, but go online and get yourself an inexpensive copy of The War Against Children of Color by Peter and Ginger Breggin. And Ginger and I, really Ginger, initially discovered the federal government was playing this huge initiative to go into the inner cities of America and identify the genetic causes of violence in little inner city children. I mean, that's youth. That's eugenics, folks. That's racism. And Ginger and I took 4 or 5 years where we really hammered this, and we actually cut off funding to just most of the programs. We got the federal government to completely review its funding of behavioral science to look out for eugenics and racism. And we got a big conference that was going to be held, sponsored by University of Maryland and the federal government, on the genetics of violence, to cancel it. And then they redid it, calling it the controversy or something. So what have you been doing since all these years?
Well, I'm retired from, I have officially retired, but I'm still volunteering for the Black Network and Children's Emotional Health and Improve, and still telling adults and children why taking drugs does not work for psychiatric disorders, just like you are. And I've invited a lot of them here because they really need to hear you. I'm really doing some non-paid work to try to get people that have relatives or themselves have schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, et cetera, et cetera. I'm warning them and sending them to the internet about the various drugs. My own children, including my son, you know, my son and daughter, are doing fine on drugless therapy, whereas the state fought me for not allowing them to take drugs. And when they forced them, both of them went berserk. It was ridiculous, but they're fine now. And there are people now who are crying and have put their relatives in institutions. The relatives are calling me because they know they cannot take these drugs and feel well. I mean, you can see the results. They're horrible. People who were perfectly doing okay because relatives felt that they needed the drugs or the doctors did, they put them on it, and when they refused to take them, they put them in institutions. So they want to get out. So I'm working with Access Living and others who want to help people get out of institutions.
Wow.
So Dr.
That's
Bragan,
wonderful. My head is still spinning from you calling. Go ahead.
Where is the Tennis Right group? You were on their panel, their board. Are they still active?
What group?
There was a, I can't think of the name, but it was psychiatric survivors, psychologists, psychiatrists, mental health practitioners. It was a National Tenants' Right Group.
Yes. No, I haven't worked with them in a long time. I do believe they are still active and hold annual meetings, but that's the group is the Rights Tenants. It's kind of an odd name, T-E-N-E-T-S. And I think they still have meetings, but I have, gosh, it's been decades since I worked with them.
I just need to refer people in their area. That's all. I'll look them up now.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I think you'll be able to find them online easily enough. And I've been limiting myself to doing co-conferencing with people because doing conferences, which is the main thing that organization does, doing conferences is very time consuming. And so I tend to now co-conference. Every year I have a conference with a woman named Pam Popper. If you go to my website, folks, Bragan.com, and look at upcoming events, and you'll see a couple of co-conferencing events that I'm doing or giving where I'm giving a major address or something like that.
When will you be in Chicago, you think?
I don't have any immediate plans to be there. So it's not something I'm aware of. I'm so glad you're still doing your work. And it's really kind of you to give me a call. It really does warm my heart to hear from you after all this time.
I'm so glad you're still active.
You know, I am as active as a man can be. And, and more and more what I've been saying for decades, you know, more and more people are understanding and talking about this. More and more scientists and psychologists and healthcare providers moving in this direction. Other countries like Great Britain, there's even bigger movements going on. So there's a lot happening, but psychiatry has all the power of the drug company. So it gets worse and worse. So psychiatry gets worse and worse while the public becomes more and more enlightened. So you have more and more people knowing that what's going on with drugs is just not good. And electroshock people don't even believe that anybody's still doing it. But psychiatry, meanwhile, while the public gets more and more aware, psychiatry manages to capture more and more people because it's got all this huge propaganda machine. It's a sad state of affairs.
And that is the latest thing in Chicago that people are fighting against. There's a place in Indiana that is still doing shock therapy.
Oh, shock is a big deal. I mean, I'm near a small city called Syracuse, and I think there are three or four shock places within an easy drive. And many universities have it. It's a big money maker. It's a huge money maker. And it's a particularly aimed at older women because they have nobody to defend them Because what usually stops shock treatment is a loving relative who says, no more of this, I'm intervening. So, you know, they can just shock elderly women and Medicare, and there's big shock mills in Florida. I mean, it's really a terrible situation. It's all, I haven't dented that at all, and I've been writing about it and doing my best, but, and there's a lot of patient groups that are deeply concerned about shock treatment, you know, you can get online and Google anti-shock groups, and you'll come across a lot of good people who some of whom have had shock in one form or another. Well, okay. I hope you too will stay in touch. Did you have a question or anything else that you want to say before we say goodbye?
You've answered the question. I had some people who could not get on the call, so I can take the information back to them. Thank you so much. I'm listening.
Well, it's great to hear from you. Great to hear from you.
Okay.
All right. Now, Kim in Ohio. Hi.
Hello. This is Kim.
Hi, Kim.
I was just calling not to have a question, just to thank you for your book, Medication Madness.
Oh, well, you're very welcome. I appreciate that. What did it do for you? How did it help you, Kim?
It helped a lot. A couple of years ago, I had a child in high school with depression and suicidal thoughts, and he called 911, and the police came and recommended I take him to a hospital for children to be evaluated, and so I did. And he was patted down for guns, and he wasn't carrying a gun. And he was evaluated at the hospital and then told they didn't have enough beds, so they transported him to an ambulance to stay overnight in a psychiatric hospital for children. And then they started...
How old was he at that point?
He was 17.
Oh, boy. What a terrifying experience for a 17-year-old to be put in an ambulance and sent to a psychiatric hospital. What a humiliating experience.
He was there for 2.5 weeks, and they gave him Ativan, Zyprexa, and Risperdal all at the same time. And when they discharged him, they told me he would have to be on meds for schizoaffective disorder the rest of his life. And after 6 months of being on these pills, and his nightmares and nausea and weight gain and those sudden limb movements, my husband took him to a natural medical doctor who believed in natural remedies, who weaned him off the drugs, and he's doing just fine now. And I just would never want anyone to have their child on those scary drugs ever again. And I'm so glad you wrote this book.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that. Did his movements go away? The movements that he developed, the abnormal movements.
Yes, they only lasted a couple of months. But the free clinic we took him to for dosing the meds wanted to put him on another drug to counteract the movements, and the drugs cost us $300 a month out of pocket. And I think the clinic was kind of experimental because. It was a free clinic for us, but I think it was all paid for by the pharmaceutical industry. So they kept putting off taking him off the drugs, and it almost feels like we were being taken advantage of.
Yeah, well, I don't know, of course, what was going on, but how long now is he off all medication now?
Yes, he's been off at least a year, if not more. And he's been going
old is he now?
He's 20. And he's been going to talk therapy, and he's getting a lot of confidence in himself. And
oh, wonderful.
He doesn't seem to need... He knows he just has to go to talk therapy and get over the stresses of life. He never thought he had any kind of mental disorder whatsoever.
Well, the stresses of life we all have to deal with, and finding a good therapist can be really wonderful for you. And can you is it okay to tell me where in Ohio you are? I don't want to give away your identity or anything.
Cincinnati.
Okay. Golly, I haven't been often to Cincinnati. My good friend Pam Popper, the nutritionist, is in Columbus, Ohio, and she's been on the radio show a few times. Now, at what point in what was happening did you get medication madness? How did it fit into what happened?
Oh, I just read about your book on the internet about a year ago. Whenever I would see in the news the bad effects of meds, people staying on meds, I would see your name kind of listed as a footnote, and then I joined your internet e-newsletter.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks, don't forget to join by signing up for free for the frequent alerts. The newsletter now has been pretty much replaced by what we call the frequent alerts. That's how we send out information around the planet now. You sign up for the frequent alerts. And they're functioning as our newsletter. And, of course, I'm so glad that people got frequent alert announcing that today was going to be an open line Wednesday, that we've gotten all these callers and really, really good calls. And people, I would like to keep, stay in touch with us. I haven't even had to repeat the number, which is 888-874-4888. The number is 888-874-4888. There are a couple of lines open now, so give a call in, and I'll keep taking calls and throughout this hour. And if we run out of callers, which is entirely possible, I'll think of something useful to say to everybody. Try my best to be useful. Kim, I'm really glad your son is doing so much better. Psychiatrists now think that people don't get better. And then they give them diagnoses, like our caller from India was talking about, his family member being diagnosed as schizophrenic or, schizoaffective disorder. And it's all the same. It's all saying, you got something, we don't know how to help. That's really what they're saying. Say, we don't know what to do about this, but we'll give you a lot of drugs. And in fact, the single most important thing that can be done for people who are distressed, and I'm not saying your son was deeply distressed, but for people who are deeply distressed, is loving family relationships with guidance, if it's available, learning to communicate in a loving way, learning to resist the temptation to get angry, to get feeling futile and helpless over the situation, to say something that isn't going to advance the relationship. One of the things I say to my clients all the time is that especially in the beginning of learning really how to relate in a friendship or a marriage, a family situation, don't say a word unless the word is going to advance the relationship. Now think about how that would be for you with your family members, your loved ones, if you got a radio show with your audience. If you thought before you spoke and thought in terms of, is this going to advance the relationship with the people whom I want to hear me? And will it enable them to talk with me more? And that can turn relationships around. And in the beginning, it can be very hard. In the beginning, you may literally have to bite your tongue. But after a while, the only time you'll have to get very conscious of what you're saying is when you feel yourself getting one of those bad signals of anger, frustration, irritability, impatience, all those bad words, those words that make us feel, well, I'm going to say what I think. When actually what you're saying is what you feel, and what you're feeling isn't going to be really useful in the moment if you express it in a way that hurts. So it's one thing to say, wow, honey, I'm finding myself getting irritable. This is terrible. Let me take a breath and do a restart here because I wanna listen to you and I don't want to be irritable with you and so on and so forth. So keep that in mind, folks. It's one of the best pieces of advice I think you can get, which is to think in advance at important times and see if what you're going to say is going to advance the relationship, whether it's a relationship with a group or an individual. And then you might even start to treat yourself that way. My wife helps me with that. Ginger will say to me, honey, don't say that about yourself. And so she helps me enhance my relationship with myself by pointing out when I'm having thoughts or saying something that isn't enhancing my relationship to myself. And when you have a loving relationship like that, it's really a miracle. So Kim, I'm gonna go now to Sarah in California.
Thank you.
Hi, Sarah.
Hello, Dr. Bregan. How are you?
I'm really a happy talk show host because I just took a flyer that if I just opened my heart and said, call in, I really want to start a new way of relating, doing this regularly. And I never imagined actually that the calls would be so uniformly thoughtful, so uniformly important. And it doesn't mean you got to be perfect every time you call in, but this is just going really well. And give me some feedback. I know I haven't been giving you feedback much on the emails. I'm going to give you some feedback by next week on the emails. But let me know how you like this format. How often would you like to do this? You want to do this once a month? You want to do it twice a month? I mean, I'm open to making this show reach more and more people. This hour, my wife says, call it a program, honey, not a show. Call it a program. So, Sarah, hi. What you calling about?
This is the second time I've called. I spoke with you the very first day.
Oh, my gosh, you were that wonderful woman who got me started with my first caller in 6 years, I think. That's great. Catch me up on stuff.
Well, so I've been working really hard at doing a plant-based diet, and I'm also working on getting rid of some of the mold toxins in my body. And I've been having an improvement in the dystonia and the tardive dyskinesia that I have been living with for the past year. But what I'm really interested in talking to you about pertains to, actually I have a couple things, but we don't have any time. So I wanted to talk to you about a study that I'm interested in conducting, because I honestly think that the only way we're going to be able to end ECT is if we can work to get it regulated. And the only way we can work to get it regulated is if we address the concerns regarding informed consent. I've discovered that a lot of times everyone talks about ECT, but they don't realize that they're talking about there's so many different forms of ECT. And so it's really like comparing apples to pineapples to any other thing that might be edible. And so in my studies, I've discovered that every single person who's published has actually, about the cognitive repercussions of ECT, they've always done so using different methodologies, and never have any of the studies been duplicated. And so I noticed that in the informed consent, a lot of times these papers would quote these statistics, and then the actual providers doing the ECT would actually use different methodology in validating the statistics that they quoted.
Yes, you're saying what we need is uniform testing of people who are getting ECT?
No, what I'm saying is that because it's an unregulated industry.
It basically is, folks, unregulated. I mean, the FDA was going to grandfather in ECT machines a few years ago as a schedule that in a category that would have not required any testing, sort of like a new toothbrush, not even one that's motorized. And then the outcry was so great that they made it a Schedule 3, which is that you have to have testing, but they have not required the testing. ECT machines have, and ECT has never been tested under the auspices of the FDA. It's never been well tested. So tell me a little more about, I mean, what you're saying sounds important. I'm a little confused by it, but certainly there have been very few replications because the populations that are being looked at are always quite different. They're often haphazard. My own opinion at this point in time is that the treatment is so dangerous it should be stopped. And no human being should be subjected to studies of ECT. Let's go back to animals if we have to, but I'm not even sure that dogs and chimpanzees and cats who have been majorly studied in the past and harmed by ECT should be subject to it. My own view is ECT is so patently irrational, so obviously abusive, so unquestionably damaging. I mean, think about it. I mean, ECT is done in the modern machines, usually with 800 amps of current. OSHA says that's enough to cause nerve damage.
It is.
And it's done in much greater intensity than the old days, when they were doing animal experiments, and they found out with very careful animal experiments that you were getting things like scattered hemorrhages in the brain, shadow cells that had cells that had died, and some of the localization of injury was around the small blood vessels, which you would expect to be damaged by the process. I mean, there was so much evidence for ECT causing harm, and so many of the mechanisms were understood. For example, people often flatline after ECT. The seizure that's caused by the ECT is so horrendous, it's so beyond an ordinary seizure, that afterward the brain cells are exhausted and they go into a temporary brain death. The EEG flatlines. I mean, that's crazy. And the modern ECT doctors, you know what they're claiming? They're claiming that if you get flatlining, it's better. And they're jacking up the amounts of energy way beyond what's required to cause the seizure. Whereas in the old days, docs would say, well, if we're going to do this, we'll give the minimal amount to cause the seizure. Now they'll give several times the amount that causes a seizure because, frankly, they know that it's the harm that is the so-called therapy, and the harm is the amount of current, the amount of charge, and the amount of energy. These are different calculations you can make for how damaging is a current. You can look at the amperage, you can look at the wattage, you can look at the current, you can look at the energy, and they're jacking it up on the recent machines because people who do ECT act very aggressively toward their patients. It's a very aggressive thing to do to another human being, and they're in that ambience, and they just go ahead, and they're doing more and more of this kind of harm to people. So the place I'm at, Sarah, at this point is this should be stopped. Any sane society would stop this. No country that I know of it even does it as frequently, as often, and as severely as we do. So we're outdoing, say, Great Britain in that regard. Go ahead, Sarah.
I completely agree. I think the only way we're going to actually be able to make a dent in this is to address it from a legal informed consent issue, because the only way we're going to be able to even put a hole in this ideology that it's beneficial is by helping people to recognize that the informed consent process, the papers that they're signing or that the loved ones are signing on behalf of the debilitated patients is so full of errors. I think the only way we're going to be able to address that and to actually outrule it is to do like a systematic audit of the methodology employed by the provider and compare it with the actual informed consent statistics that the patients are given in creating that decision and making that decision.
Well, you know, by the way, all of this is just a thoughtful conversation, and I'm going to share my own, you know, concerns about it, but I'm really glad that you're bringing up these issues, and this is going to enlighten a lot of people. Many people don't even know what's going on now, but all big cities have shock factories now.
San Diego, we have at least 12.
Yeah, but let me say my problem with what you're saying is most of the people who consent to ECT, if they actually consent, a lot of people get pushed into it. But if they're actually saying, yes, I want the treatment, in my experience, they're into such a state of self-hate and often of a kind of a subtle suicidality that they're doing it to hurt themselves or to put themselves out of their misery. And so they're consenting out of a deep depression, and that's not a consent. So the people who are getting ECT are commonly in no position to actually consent to something highly dangerous. Then the second thing is once you've had one ECT, and then even more so if you've had two or three, you're not capable of resisting the ECT. You're not capable of understanding the consent, of protesting. You become docile. I mean, I did years ago, I was on 60 Minutes as a commentator, where ECT had been used to subdue a group of African American protesters on a U.S. Navy ship. This is back in, I think, the 80s. I'm not exactly sure when anymore. But these ECT brain injury subdues people. People come out of ECT hugely subdued. And if you give it to them more regularly, they get more and more subdued, and then they can have a lifetime of being subdued after the ECT. And so they can't even exert their right to informed consent. So it's things like that that have led me to say, we need to call for just a flat-out halt for this. So what do you think? What do you think about what I'm saying, Sarah? Because it's complicated. It's
you know, I am all for having an all-out ban on it. But I think the psychiatric community has fueled this in such a light. I mean, recently they just had the 60 Minutes presentation and they didn't even show both sides of the issue. So they dragged out dear Kitty Dukakis to say how much it did for her. She's always their go-to person. And they spoke with other people who had benefited from it, but they did not speak to a single person who had been harmed by it, like myself. I've lost 36 years of my life because I had more than 100 ECT treatments, bilateral ECT treatments.
I have to finish up now. We're going to have to continue this conversation later. I got so involved, I lost track of the time. And let's stay in touch. And folks, thank you for a great send-off for this show. Remember, I can't deal with emergency situations. We've gotten a call about that. I can't deal with a medical crisis. That's not what a talk show can do. So please, if you're in a life-threatening situation, get some help. But that's not what I can provide. Thank you so, so much from around the world. Bye-bye now.